The things that made him unique are different than the words we read by the inspired prophets of old. Now, when we think about the appeal of Jesus, it seems to me that as from last week's reading, when we looked at Isaiah 52, there was nothing that was spectacular about Jesus. In fact, it is suggested that he was a homely man. And therefore, if we have the view of Jesus as some good-looking movie star, who's often used to portray him in movies, some good-looking movie star with hair that most every woman would envy, and with a beard that was fantastically trim and neat and didn't look like a jihadist. But there's no indication that he was that at all. The reality may have been, and this is Joe Shane's speculation, the reality may have been that he was one ugly man. Nothing good looking about him at all. Nothing that would make Mary Magdalene and others swoon because Jesus walked by. I don't think it was his physical appeal. I don't think it was his fashions. It certainly wasn't his education and academic learning. And it wasn't that he put on a good show before he did his miracles. He had something to say, and he said it. And the things that he said are what caused these men to go back to the high priests and say, no man ever spoke like this man. So let's take a couple of minutes and look at some of the things that we find to be true. Jesus spoke with such divine authority. Now we need to remember this in a context that we probably don't experience much. We may from time to time, especially among our Republican and Democrat politicians, where they'll talk a good talk and they'll, who knows what they'll end up doing. But the Jews were familiar with, and they were used to, very self-righteous, very pompous Pharisees in very long robes and scribes who looked like majestic people and Sadducees who certainly had the wealth to be impressive, who would walk around and make their proclamations and make sure that you understood that their proclamations were the things to be known and understood and followed. But consider the fact that when Jesus made proclamations at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, with all the great things he said about the Beatitudes, and then as he expanded on various aspects of the law, it was concluded there in Matthew the 7th chapter, verse 29, "For he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes." In Matthew the 28th chapter, that authority is clearly seen when Jesus proclaims in verse 28, "All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth," so that none need doubt, none need question that he spoke with divine authority. That divine authority was seen in the fact that Paul proclaims in Colossians the 3rd chapter and verse 17, "And whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him." That's the authority with which he spoke as no man had ever spoken. Not only did he have that divine authority, but he spoke with a divine effect. Consider, if you will, the events that transpired during the course of his life. I'll read and then set up the text here in Matthew 8. "But he said to them, 'Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?'" What was going on? Fishermen are in a boat. And fishermen in a boat are afraid. And I will promise you that if I'm ever in a boat with a fisherman who is afraid, a boatsman who is afraid, I will be terrified. Because they know what to be afraid about. What does Jesus do? "Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, "Who can this be that even the winds and the sea obey him?" That is divine effect. That's one of the reasons those men said, "Never a man spoke like this man." He stilled the tempest. He gave sight to the blind. He gave hearing to those who were deaf. He allowed those who were unable to speak to speak. Those were the effects of the words of Jesus. They were like none other. He took a lame man and told him, "Take up your bed and walk." He took a man who wasn't able to get to the waters, as Benny had mentioned to us Wednesday night. He told him, "Take up your bed and walk." On more than one occasion, he did so. But he also gave the forgiveness of sins. And none other has done that with the effect of his sacrifice. Others have proclaimed through God forgiveness of sins, but never did anybody make such a proclamation based on who he was and what he would fulfill within his life. I think one of the things that really can stir you is the idea that he raised the dead. Here's the story of Lazarus, in John 9. Here's the story of Lazarus in John 11, 43 and 44. Now remember, this is the man who'd been in the grave 4 days, in the tomb. "Now when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come forth!' And he who had died came out bound, hand and foot, with grave cloths. And his face was wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, 'Loose him and let him go.'" Can you imagine this spectacle? Have you ever watched a silly mummy movie where the mummy comes up having been wrapped up in cloth? Listen, that's what they were dealing with here. They see the tombs were accessible most of the time because there would be a number of people buried within the tombs. They see what we today might call a mummy, wrapped head to toe. I don't know if he was able to shuffle his feet, almost looking silly, or if he was hopping, or if they had wrapped him individually where he came walking out with his eyes covered. Why do you think the Pharisees... I think we sometimes forget this. You know who was on the hit list with Jesus when they crucified him? Lazarus. The leaders wanted Lazarus dead too. In the same basic roundup, and I use that term loosely, but when they got Jesus, they wanted to also get Lazarus. Because Lazarus was evidence, was walking evidence of the effect of what happens when Jesus speaks. When we think of that story and we think of the power of it, we certainly see the divine effect. And therefore, when we think about even Jesus' answer when they were asking, "Are you the one?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Go and tell John the things that you have heard and that you hear and see. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who is not offended because of me." That's the divine effect of Jesus. No man spoke such as him because of the divine simplicity. He spoke with such simplicity and with such depth. Consider what is said over in Mark, the 12th chapter, beginning at verse 35. It says, "Then Jesus answered and said, while he taught in the temple, 'How is it that the scribes say that the Christ is the son of David? For David himself said by the Holy Spirit, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool." Therefore, David himself calls him Lord. How is he then his son? The common people heard him gladly. Because what Jesus had done here was turned all the scribes and all the Pharisees in all their great pontifications about David and about the coming Messiah and relationships had turned it on its head. And the people said, "I get it. I get him." That's the simplicity. That's why they were gladly willing to hear him. He did not try to impress with words. If you go through the speeches of David or of Jesus, if you go through the monologues that he presents, there are some that are beautiful, but not a lot. In my opinion, not a lot. There aren't a lot of the sermons that he gives that have the beauty of the 23rd Psalm. But there's a simplicity there that is unparalleled. And that's why they came back to the rulers and said, "No one's ever spoken like this man." How about the tender kindness? And again, sometimes in the time frame that they lived, we don't get the gravity of this tender kindness. They didn't have Social Security. They didn't have any kind of social safety net set up within the government. There were responsibilities of caring for the poor from the temple taxes. There was a responsibility for caring for one another as you could, but nothing really like we have today. And therefore, there were a lot of cases where people who were very highly regarded as leaders of the people who could be seen stepping around that stinky, poor man laying there, messing up the area around our robes as we walk by him. And then there's that other class of people that, we're just too refined to have anything to do with that. That beggar over there that is blind, a kind word to him? Yeah, find out where your parents are to help you out. As I go on my way, I and my entourage of other learned scribes or Pharisees or Sadducees. I suspect we as people have a greater sense of kindness than many people did in that day and in many societies. So perhaps this point sometimes is lost on us, but he had a tender kindness that made him different to the people around him. Over in John, the 8th chapter, this is the woman who was caught up in adultery, was dragged out and humiliated. Jesus has rebuffed those who brought her. And then in verse 10, when Jesus had risen and raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." He would have had every right to read her the riot act. And there were times when he did. But it's interesting that you'll find that most of the time Jesus read the Riot Act to people, it was to people who knew the law and knew what should have been done. He read the Riot Act to the scribes, the Pharisees, and the Sadducees. Now, this woman knew not to commit adultery. She had been humiliated because of her sin. The other had not been there, the male part to this adultery. Their intent wasn't to bring about biblical justice, it was to get Jesus. Jesus knows that she's aware of her sin. Jesus knows she was at the brink of being stoned to death. And Jesus chooses at that time, and I hope I'm not putting too much into the mind of Jesus here, but Jesus knew that what she needed was that sense of rightness, because she had not been judged rightly. She may have been judged correctly and condemned, but they hadn't done that to her. But he's not going to leave her either with the sense that, oh, you got off scot-free, get out of here and don't get caught. His kindness was indeed, go and sin no more. I suspect, go and sin no more was as heavy a sermon of conviction to her as any of the berating that she heard from the moment she was caught in the adultery, as she was being dragged through the street and dragged to the assembly around Jesus. It was his kindness. It was his tender kindness. We find also there was a firmness about him. And as I said before, that firmness was seen especially with those who knew what they should be doing and did not. As he says in Matthew 23, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees." Now here's a good one. "Hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers, and therefore you will receive greater condemnation." There are times when it is necessary to get to the point and say, here's the sin that you're engaged in, and it's got to stop. And Jesus was willing to do that. You see, take just a moment and flip the circumstances of what we talked about just a moment ago. Some of us would have no trouble with that adulterous woman there just having barely escaped death, knowing we hadn't committed adultery, and we'll read her the Riot Act one more time and she heads down the road. She's weak. She's already guilty and everybody knows it. She's most vulnerable. But what does Jesus do? He shows kindness. Flip it. The people that knew the law, knew the word, should have known the Messiah. That's who he saved his firmness for. That's who he saved his godly wrath for. You should have known better. And look at some of the things. You read the 23rd chapter. Look at the things you're doing. You're taking everything from these widows. Shame on you, scribes and Pharisees. And he goes on with point after point. Calls them hypocrites. Calls them stiff-necked. He had firmness. Jesus wasn't a marshmallow. He wasn't all soft and fuzzy. And, well, marshmallows aren't fuzzy unless they've gotten bad. He wasn't all soft and mushy and, oh, I don't want to ever condemn sin. He laid it out there. And He laid it out there proportional to the knowledge and responsibility and accountability of those who were in His audience. And let me say, just as an aside, I hold this congregation in such high regard that there are times when I feel it will be necessary to be firm with you because you've got the knowledge, you've got the awareness, and I think you've got the hearts that want to do right. And so every lesson isn't a, oh, everything's hunky-dory fine. There are lessons I hope have been and will be at times that will be firm. Jesus spoke with firmness at times. Look at how He spoke of God. I and my Father are one. That's a sermon all in and of itself, and it simply shows that He said, before the world began, I was there. In fact, in John, the first chapter, a couple of verses, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, and all things were made through Him, and without anything, nothing was made that was made. And then you get down to verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. No man could speak of God like that. And no one can speak of man as Jesus spoke of man. He said, what is a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? There's no profit. On the day of judgment, your 401k and my 401k will not mean a thing. Your house and my house, your car, my car, won't mean anything. So Jesus says, or what will a man give in exchange for his soul? Young ladies, a guy that sweeps you off your feet in exchange for your soul? Young men, a 12 on a scale of 10 for a young lady? No. What will you give in exchange for your soul is a question that you and I, at any age in our lives, need to stop and ask ourselves when we're contemplating something, what will I give in exchange for my soul? And I think the answer for everybody present, at least on the surface, is nothing. Let's make that within our lives as well. The answer is nothing. And so He spoke of man as none other. Of His enemies, what does He tell us? In Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, 44, but I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who despitefully use you and persecute you. That's our attitude toward our enemies. Give careful consideration to how you retaliate to those who have done you wrong. The easy response is to be justified in a retaliation that is greater than that which was done to us. But Jesus says, give pause and contemplate what your enemy will see in you. Will they see Christ living in us? And I would hope that the answer is yes. And to our final point this morning, never man spoke like this man when it comes to salvation. There in John 3, the religious world misses the power of this because they have simplified it to ignore the totality of what Christ has done. But nonetheless, in 3:14 through 16, "And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so the Son of Man will be lifted up, that whoever believes in Him should not perish, but have eternal life. For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in Him should not perish, but have everlasting life." Nobody else can say that. Nobody else can step up to us and speak of salvation in the first person as Christ was able to do. And therefore, when He says to the disciples in Mark 16, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He who believes and is baptized will be saved, but he who does not believe will be condemned." He brought it down very simply to this. Look, go tell others to John 3:16. And when you've John 3:16, die with me in baptism. Be buried and rise to walk in newness of life. I've shared with the audience, most in the audience, this point as I've talked to people and they've brought this, when I brought this passage up, they, on the baptism question, want to get hung up and say, but the other half doesn't say, he who is not baptized will be condemned. My first response is quite simply this. Do you want to study the part of the verse that talks about being saved, or do you want to study the part of the verse that talks about being condemned? And thus far in my life, people have said, I want to talk about the part of the verse that says, what do I do to be saved? Jesus can speak of our salvation because He died that we might have salvation. And so, no man ever spoke like this man with such divine authority, divine effect, simplicity, kindness, firmness, spoke of God, spoke of man, spoke of His enemies, and spoke of salvation. Let us all indeed agree. No matter what great speeches we hear by men, no one has ever spoken like Jesus. We're about to sing a song of encouragement. And the purpose of the song of encouragement is for those who may not have yet put on Christ in baptism to understand the value. The question that is asked at about every gathering we have is, when Jesus says, come to me, will you come? Or will you not? I would hope that the answer for us each is that we will come. If you have a need to respond to the invitation, we invite you to have a seat at the front as we stand together and as we sing.